and lead scientist of MEG laboratory at Aston University in UK. Her research has covered a range of different topics, from auditory perception, neurodevelopmental disorders, such as dyslexia, and is also a specialist for different methods for research in children, both behavioral and neuroimaging. She has also had a particular recent focus on the application of methods in MEG for clinical research. As the custos appointed by the Faculty of Education and Psychology, I declare this public examination open.
Distinguished custos, honored opponent, ladies and gentlemen, language acquisition requires complex cognitive skills to be developed in the human brain. The ability to connect written language successfully with spoken language results in typical reading acquisition. In general, fluent reading skills are very important for a successful life and professional career. Typical reading acquisition requires the ability to convert the written orthographical forms into spoken language, as well as the ability to manipulate efficiently the smallest meaningful units of language, the morphemes. That means that phonological processing, speech perception, and morphological processing are very important skills for typical reading acquisition. However, there are many individuals who deal with reading difficulties and they cannot develop typical reading skills. Developmental dyslexia is a reading difficulty mainly related with problems in phonological processing and speech perception, and it is inheritable within family members, which means that a child is very likely to inherit dyslexia from his parents. There is considerable diversity across people with developmental dyslexia, as there are also dyslexic individuals without phonological difficulties but with visual attention difficulties. Since phonological and morphological awareness are both known to play an important role in reading acquisition, we thought that problems in morphophonological information processing could arguably be associated with developmental dyslexia, especially for Finnish, which is a rich morphologically language. This is the first dissertation thesis which focused on derivational morphology in young children. Derivational morphology is one of the three morphological processes used for the formation and creation of words. This means that the speaker can formulate words by adding one or more morphemes per stem or word, happy, happiness, unhappiness. Our research studies were focused on morphological sensitivity and processing of young children before and after they receive formal literacy education. Successful learning of the correspondences between graphemes, letters, and morpheme sounds is vital for learning to read in transparent languages like Finnish. Finnish language is a non-Indo-European language, and it belongs to the Uralic language family. Finnish has an alphabetic writing system, and it is an almost fully transparent with swallow orthography, where each letter corresponds to one phonemic sound. Despite its easy phonological system, the Finnish language owns a quite complex morphological system. It is characterized by its rich inflectional and derivational morphology. A high amount of nominals are produced by derivational operations. Children can learn accurately how to read in Finnish quite fast after 1 year of formal reading instruction. The overall aim of this dissertation is to examine the development of morphological processing skills at the cognitive and brain level in children with and without familial risk for dyslexia before and after formal reading instruction. For our research studies, a longitudinal sample of native Finnish-speaking children was tested at preschool age, and again, the same children were tested at first grade age. The participants at first grade were the same as the ones at preschool. The participants were screened with a questionnaire filled out by the parents. At both ages, we included children with familial risk for dyslexia. The participants with familial risk were required to have at least one parent and/or sibling with a diagnosis of developmental dyslexia and/or one parent with self-perceived reading difficulties. Several behavioral tests were also carried out by the participants at both ages in each measurement session on a different appointment at the Department of Psychology at the University of Jyväskylä. The cognitive assessment included phonological awareness, rapid automatic naming, letter knowledge, word pseudo-word list reading, and other tasks. We used magnetoencephalography, MEG, to record brain activity. MEG is a direct, silent, and non-invasive neuroimaging method. It provides high temporal resolution on a millisecond level information on brain activity and good estimates of brain regions activating in different tasks. With MEG, it is possible to measure how the brain deals with linguistic information, which is important for reading. Brain data are very important when measuring underlying processes not visible in overt behavior, especially in young children. We also developed a morphological task for Finnish language to activate specific language-related systems during brain activity recording. This task was created in a child-friendly way, with its core purpose being to examine young children's brain sensitivity in relation to morphologically complex Finnish derivational morphology. The task included words consisting of a verb and a noun derived from the verb with the derivational suffix -ia, which is broadly used to form a noun from a verb in Finnish. For example, johta, which means to lead, forms the noun johtaja, which means leader. The word pairs were created in two categories, real words and pseudo words. The real words were selected from a Finnish corpus of words. Additionally, within each condition for real words and pseudo words, we added two more subconditions, the correctly derived nouns from the verbs and the incorrectly derived nouns from the verbs. The correctly derived nouns were represented by derivational forms derived from a verb in a correct grammatical way. On the contrary, the incorrectly derived nouns were represented by derivational forms created with an incorrect morphophonological replacement in the last vowel before the suffix. For all the incorrectly derived forms existing in real words and pseudo words, the last vowel of the derived noun was always replaced with another vowel without violating the Finnish vowel harmony rules. Study 1 focused on morphological processing and awareness regarding the reading skills of preschool children with and without familial risk for dyslexia. In Study 1, we examined the brain activity of preschool children with typical development to find out whether they could differentiate pairs of sentences, including correct and incorrect derivational suffixes, for pseudo words and real words. We also explored the sensitivity of preschool children with familial risk for dyslexia to differentiate correctly and incorrectly derived words and pseudo words to determine possible different pathways of brain responses between children at risk and typically developing children. Behavioral differences in the accuracy and reaction time performance were examined in both groups. Significant differences between groups were observed for the accuracy for correctly derived real words. The typically developing group was more accurate than the group at risk for dyslexia. No significant differences were observed in any other measures. At the brain level, the most substantial findings of Study 1 were that the brain activation of both typically developing and at risk for dyslexia children showed sensitivity to morphological information processing for real words. Study 1 reported that brain responses were different for the correctly versus incorrectly derived words in the first time window of analysis in typically developing children and similarly in the first time window in children with familial risk for dyslexia. These brain activity responses observed in both groups were enhanced at a similar time window and they evolved a similar cluster's location, left occipitotemporal region. It seems that the upcoming morphological information was processed in a similar way regarding timing and topography between groups. These very early brain activations observed in the two groups could suggest that, independently of their risk profiles, children were engaging in phonetic phonological processes which happen in the brain when they recognize native phonetic and phonological units, the real words. Moreover, Study 1 revealed a significant difference for the derivational contrast in the middle time window in both groups, but the cluster's topographies were different. Children at risk for dyslexia had additional brain differences being more enhanced for the correctly derived words emerging in two and other time points of the middle time window. Our results showed that the timing of the appearance of the enhanced responses in children at risk occurred a bit later than the observed timing compared to the typically developing children enhanced responses. The current results clearly coupled with the classical N400 responses. The N400 component has been found to emerge mainly in sentences with semantically incongruent endings, and it reflects the individual's attempt to access the semantic representation of a given word or sentence. Thus, the results of Study 1 seem to be reasonably well matched between young children and adults regarding timing for the processing of lexicosemantic information. Furthermore, Study 1 measured significant brain activation differences for correct and incorrect morphological contrast in the late time window in preschool children, as well as in preschool children at risk for dyslexia. These differences clearly matched with the P600 responses, which are related to semantic and syntactic violations that could alter the meaning of a whole sentence. Previous studies have suggested that the P600 involved two processing stages. The first stage represents integration difficulties, and the second phase represents an attempt to reanalyze and compensate for the integration difficulties. The enhanced responses found in preschool children without risk resemble to the first P600 responses, while the brain responses of preschool children with risk for dyslexia seem to deal with difficulties with processes of syntactic assimilation, and they engage themselves in reanalysis and reconstruction processes. For pseudowords, Study 1 reported that typically developing children's brain activation at preschool age showed differences for the correctly and incorrectly derived pseudowords in the first time window and in the middle time window. The activation in the first time window could be linked to an attempt for lexical access based on long-term phonological representations, since the pseudowords represent potential and not real words. Brain activation for pseudowords in preschool children at risk for dyslexia demonstrated that processing differences occurred bilaterally, as the children's brain responses showed sensitivity to the difference in the first time window in the left and right parietal regions. This significant difference occurring very early in time probably activates phonetic phonological representations in the brain when hearing a pseudoword, which included a pseudostem and a real suffix, because the pseudowords were creating without violating the rules of Finnish vowel harmony. Study 2 examined the brain basis of morphological processing in early readers with and without risk for dyslexia. Specifically, in Study 2, we examined auditory brain responses during MEG recordings of first-grade children with typical development, as depicted in their sensitivity to the difference between correctly and incorrectly derivational real words and pseudowords. We tested the differences in brain activity for the same morphological contrast, and then we ran within-group comparisons to identify possible brain activity differences between typically developing and at least for dyslexia children. Behavioral results for the accuracy and reaction time differences during the MEG morphological task were examined in both groups. There were no significant differences in any of the tested conditions between typically developing and at-risk children with dyslexia during first grade. Second, we tested within-group differences of auditory event-related fields in first-grade children with and without risk. The ERFs of the children without risk for dyslexia showed sensitivity to morphological information in various time points. Study 2 indicated the existence of a significant activation for the difference between in the first time window in the left occipitotemporal region. A similar response emerged in the first time window in first grade children at risk for dyslexia in the same left occipitotemporal region and later in the left frontal parietal and temporal regions. In general, our results found many similarities between both groups for dyslexia regarding timing and topography. Study 2 also showed that the first grade typically developing group had stronger brain activity in various time points of the middle time window in the left temporal parietal region, in the left frontal region and right regions, and in the left temporal region. The timing of effects found in the late time window in first grade children is linked to the early P600 responses and to the late P600 responses when the individual attempts to respond to restore these compromised processes. It is worth mentioning that typically developing first grade children were found to engage in both early and late P600 processes, which illustrates that they not only come across with challenges with syntactic processing, but also seem to be efficient in going through the reanalysis repair process of the syntactically compromised stimuli. Further, study 2 demonstrated that first grade children with typical development could recognize and differentiate the correctly and incorrectly derived pseudowords at the behavioral level, but not in the brain level. On the contrary, first grade children at risk for dyslexia showed significant brain activity for the morphological differences in the middle time window and in the left parietal temporal and occipital regions and in the left temporal region. The early difference in the first time window could represent the at-risk children's attempt at lexical processing of the upcoming stimuli, where the correctly derived pseudowords seem to be potential Finnish words. Moreover, the later effect in the middle time window emerged due to both semantic violation, pseudostem, and the syntactic violation. Generally, it is somewhat surprising that only the at-risk children showed sensitivity at the brain level for the morphological contrast of the correct and incorrect derivational pseudowords. Previous studies have demonstrated that the existence of a real stem or a real suffix in a word made it more difficult for adult participants to identify and reject a pseudoword during a lexical decision task. These findings could explain the non-significant differences in the first grade typically developing children between correctly and incorrectly derived pseudowords. Study 3 examined children's morphological information processing skills longitudinally from preschool age to first grade age. First, we aim to compare cognitive skills at both preschool and first grade to check the developmental differences before and after formal literacy education. Also, study 3 investigated the association between morphological information processing at preschool and reading development in first grade with correlations between preschool behavioral performance during the MEG morphological task with first grade reading-related cognitive skills. The results showed that the preschool morphological measures during MEG were associated with the first grade cognitive skills. Reaction time for correctly derived real words in preschool children was found to be significantly correlated with rapid naming of letters in first grade children. Previous literature has already illustrated the importance of RAN in predicting reading fluency skills in the Finnish and in other orthographies. This association between preschool morphological information and naming of letters at first grade brought up new understanding about morphological processing. It seems that morphological processing is closely associated with reading fluency measured by RAN letters, and RAN letters measure the fluency of lexical access to already build up lexical representations. Also, the results of study 3 replicated earlier findings. The behavioral performance of preschool children in tasks including phonological processing, RAN, letter knowledge, and verbal short-term memory could be considered good predictors of school-age reading skills. Strong correlations were found between ages for the block design, vocabulary, digits fun, phonological processing, RAN objects, word list reading, and non-word list reading tasks. Phonological processing skills of preschool children were systematically associated with first grade children repetition of nonsense words, sentence repetition, RAN objects, RAN letters, word list reading, and non-word list reading. Preschool children's word list reading was correlated with first grade children sentence repetition, RAN letters, dictation, and non-word list reading. Additionally, preschool children's non-word list reading was found to be associated with first grade children repetition of nonsense words, sentence repetition, RAN letters, dictation, and word list reading. Our studies showed that preschool children and first grade children with typical development are sensitive to morphological information processing. Similarly, children with familiar predisposition for dyslexia are also sensitive to morphological information processing. Overall, we found out associations between preschool behavioral assessments and first grade reading skills. In general, our research studies offered a better understanding about language-related processes in typical and atypical reading development already before formal literacy education. Our studies gave a broader knowledge about the development of morphological processing, especially of derivational morphology skills in young children. In the future, our morphological task could be used as a cognitive test for early screening in young children. Studies 1 and 2 would be a fascinating approach for future studies to investigate the brain areas that are involved in morphological processing through the scope of derivational morphology. Future research could use our longitudinal design to study derivational morphology in older children, adolescents, and adults using our morphological task to reveal morphological development from a preliterate age throughout adulthood. Honored opponent, as the opponent appointed by the faculty, please present the comments that you see my dissertation has given grounds for.
Christos, Ms. Lulelli, and distinguished colleagues. First of all, may I say what an honour it is to be here at a university that has such a strong and well-respected track record for work in this area. Thank you so much for your presentation, which was very clear, very interesting. And I understand that this is the first thesis that has been written on this topic using derivational morphology. Yeah. So it's particularly fascinating from that point of view. And it's also very important, I think, with the vast amount of research on reading disability and linguistics that takes place in the English language around the world, it is particularly important to see things being done in languages such as Finnish, and this really enhances the applicability of your research and the possibility that it can enhance the lives of real children. I think a particular strength of it is the longitudinal approach, which is really difficult to achieve in the context of a PhD, so you have done extremely well to do that. And it makes it particularly interesting to read. And I think that throughout your thesis, as well as in your presentation, I was particularly impressed with the very careful and detailed presentation of your results that you made. It clearly represents a huge amount of work, and it was a pleasure to read. Having said that, I have a number of questions that I would like to ask you and some things that I would like to discuss with you about your thesis, if that's all right with you.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so I wondered if we could start by thinking about the general context of your thesis. And I know that you come to this work with a background in linguistics. Yes. So can you tell us a little bit, first of all, just about why you chose derivational morphology as the topic, because I understand that this was your choice. So can you tell me a little bit more from your perspective about why you chose derivational morphology as the particular topic of interest for this work?
Okay, thank you very much for your question. So to start with, in my PhD, I wanted to combine my knowledge in linguistics and psycholinguistics with cognitive neuroscience, my knowledge in MET research, with Finnish language and dyslexia, because I'm very interested in the learning difficulties and especially the reading difficulties. And Finnish language is a very interesting language in the sense that it's a transparent language, but it has a very rich morphological system. Usually, the majority of the studies are focused on the inflectional morphology. So there are two kinds of morphology, inflectional and derivational. Most of the studies focus on the inflectional morphology because it's the one that is learned prior to derivational and usually represents the grammatical way of constructing the words. Derivational morphology is more productive way as compounding, to construct new words. So I was very fascinated by the opportunities that Finnish language were given us to study this and see if there are any problems with when we see from the scope of dyslexia in children yes. with and without risk for dyslexia. We also wanted to study derivational morphology before and after school age to see how the reading, the formal literacy education at school affects derivational morphology yes. before they learn to read and after they yeah. learn to read.
Absolutely. So that's very interesting. And I wondered if you could elaborate a little bit more on why learning to read specifically. So in the process of learning to read, we acquire these letter-to-sound correspondences. And clearly you are envisaging possibly a causal pathway between phonology that is acquired in learning to read and the acquisition of real skills for derivational morphology that is separate from just developmental changes that happen at that part of that time of life, in that age. So preschool here is the age going from about 6 to 7 years old.
Yeah.
So what is it specifically about learning to read that alters how you might expect the brain to process derivational morphology?
Okay, so learning to read, we start first from speech perception when we learn the phonetic phonological representations of our language, and then we try to convert them into written forms mm-hmm. and be able to do the mapping from yes. the phonetics to the written forms. Morphology is a continuum of phonology, so I don't want to see them separately. I would like to talk about morphophonology.
Okay.
Because it is a continuum and they don't have clear borders when you can say here starts phonology and here starts okay. morphology. So they are interconnected, of course, mm-hmm. because the morphemes are consisted of phonemes, mm-hmm. but they are bigger. Bigger sound forms, and they have some meaning. That meaning is not semantical meaning, it's meaning, it's a grammatical meaning, or it can give the gender orientation or the past tense, depending on the language.
Yes.
In this one we had the adjective noun that we were producing from a verb in our task, a noun, so lead, leader, mm-hmm. by adding a yeah. morpheme at the end, and we would like to see, we wanted to see this how these processes affect the pre-reading and the post-reading mm-hmm. skills
yeah.
of children.
That makes a lot of sense, and I think what's nice from my perspective is that being more embedded in the literature on English, on the English language, that it's quite a novel perspective for me. It was quite an interesting journey for me to read more about how morphology and phonology are linked, because we don't think about that as much, perhaps, in English. Okay. So, just carrying on a little bit in thinking about your general approach to this thesis, and you did address this in your talk a little bit, and I'd like to drill down a little bit more into why you think it's important to have brain data specifically. So we could measure, and in fact you did very clearly measure children's understanding of derivational morphology behaviourally, but what do you expect to get that's different to that from brain data specifically? Why do we, and perhaps even in general, why do we need brain data to back up our understanding?
Yes. Okay, we are doing brain research. Of course, it's very good if you have a big continuum starting from behavioral data and mm-hmm. brain data, so to see all of the aspects of language and reading. So we started with behavioral data, cognitive tests.
Yes.
Where the cognitive tests represent the outcome of a whole series of processes, mm-hmm. while the brain data corresponds to the outcome while the processing is happening in the brain, so we
yeah.
can focus on that. while measuring brain data.
Okay.
And of course, we can focus on the temporal and spatial resolution.
Yes, yeah.
And do a lot of fascinating stuff.
So it's about, so I guess that often we may, as neuroscientists, we may fall into the trap of saying, well, we want to know the brain data because we're interested in the brain.
Yes.
But perhaps, perhaps sometimes that's not enough to say, well, because of course we're interested in the brain, but we're going to put all these children through the experience of doing these experiments. So perhaps what you're getting at is the fact that we may unpick mechanisms, so we may get a more detailed understanding of how things happen.
Yes. Of the underlying mechanisms, like a role that lead us to the overt behavior that we see on the behavioral data.
Yeah.
So by measuring the brain data, we see the processes that happen in the brain, and then they give us the behavioral responses.
That explain the,
we could explain more. Yes.
Yeah. So maybe we'll come back to that in some of the things that we talk about later on, because I think that's always an interesting, when we if we try and stand back from our work and ask ourselves, why are we doing it? Then that's, I guess that this is one of the issues, isn't it? How do we, are we learning something different from the brain data or not? And of course, a lot of that depends on the results that you get as well. Okay. So, so you've come here to this wonderful centre that is world-renowned for evoked responses with a lot of expertise around you. And you had... so we've established that you wanted to do to collect brain data, but you chose MEG.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit more about why MEG as opposed to EEG or... I mean, that you may not have had the option for other techniques, but why MEG was the technique to use for these children?
Okay. MEG is a silent and very direct neuroimaging method that has very good estimates of space very good estimates of excellent spatial and temporal resolution.
Yeah.
We can measure the whole head.
Yes.
So in our department, we have the 306 Elekta system. Mm-hmm. So we can measure the entire head.
Yeah.
And it has, we can also take MEG data and do source localization and more, even connectivity and coherent studies.
Yeah, okay. And recording from children is always harder than recording from adults. We know that all the MEG systems, or nearly all the MEG systems that are available, at least the old-fashioned MEG systems that are available in the world, were designed for the adult-sized head and for adult-sized people to sit there with their heads in the helmet. Can you tell me a little bit more about any challenges that you faced from recording from children and about how you overcame those? I mean, first of all, what are the problems that you might encounter in doing MEG with children?
Okay. Yes. Collecting data, make data from children is quite challenging. First, their heads are small.
Yeah.
So we need, and also their body is small, so we need to find a way to fit them in the scanner quite up so that the head is up in the sensors. Then we managed to find a way to create stories and so that they are not afraid in getting into the room because the room is sealed, so it's when you close the door, you are alone inside and it might be scary. In the preschool children, because they were quite small, our research assistants were inside the room during the measurement. And usually in our in each measurement session, we were starting first with the cognitive assessments. So the children, we were getting used to the whole testing strategy, and then we were getting them on the next session to the MEG room, so they were already a bit prepared of how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, when we were preparing with the HPI coils, it was very funny to take them pictures and show them.
Yes.
And after the sessions, to give them diplomas as little scientists, so they were happy to yes. to be there.
So it's a whole, it's your whole approach is geared towards the children and their needs. So how long did the children have to sit still for in the machine? And did you do anything to make them sit still, or did you use head movement correction algorithms to correct for any movements? Were there any problems in relation to that?
So it's the morphological task was separated into two sets. So we had a break in the middle, mm-hmm. but it approximately lasted 40 minutes inside the skull.
Okay, so that's
then we had half an hour of the preparation. So mm-hmm. it was
quite a long time.
Long time.
And are there any differences? So then the question, I hesitate here, because in the UK a preschool child is 4 years old, or three to 4 years old. Yeah. So I'm thinking about trying to think about 6 year olds who haven't been to school yet. And I'm wondering if there are any, is there any likelihood of differences, for example, in amount of movement, or indeed in brain anatomy, between a 6 and a 7 year old, so a preschool child and a school age child at that age? I mean, do you think, was that a concern for you in thinking about just other differences that are not related to derivational morphology or literacy or anything like that, but other things that could affect the data because you're comparing across time points?
Yes. Okay, in both ages they were very small children, so either 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. So we didn't see any, you need more time to see like more development, physical development, yeah. or growth,
yes.
Also in the brain. So they were quite small, yeah. time points in that sense. Yes.
Yeah, but behaviorally they were presumably...
They were very well in both ages. Very
okay.
Yes.
So you didn't see big differences in head movement, for example, or anything like that?
No. And the dropout criteria was only 2 children at preschool age,
yes.
Left because they were afraid of the machine. And at first grade age, we didn't have any dropouts. So they were quite determined.
Okay. And this is another question from somebody who's naive about the Finnish system, but I noticed that your preschool children could read a few words, yes. on average.
Yes.
So is that a problem in your research design? So, for example, does the amount that they can read before school, does that depend on their family background? Does it, are there things that you have to control for? Is there a big variability in how much reading children have before school in,
yes.
Finland, before they have proper reading instruction?
Actually, we checked the family background when we divided the groups without risk and with risk for dyslexia.
Yes.
But there were no differences in that.
Okay.
In
that's that's quite important.
And yeah. usually, in Finland, the kids learn to read quite fast because of the fully transparent languages and the,
yes.
letter correspondences, so they might learn from family or from,
yes.
TV. Or,
yeah. Yes, and once they have acquired a bit of phonological knowledge, then it's very easy,
yes.
for them to acquire that reading vocabulary, I suppose.
Yes.
Yeah.
But not all of them were readers, or they could read just small words. Or,
yes.
But our task was auditory, so it,
yes.
was,
so yeah. So really, it affects the. It affects your cognitive measures, Okay, but there was no overt differences between the groups in terms of their preschool reading exposure. Okay, so you collected quite a lot of data during your PhD, and that's great to see. Did you think about statistical power or anything before you started? How did you know how many participants to recruit for your study? Did you have an idea, or was it limited by availability of participants? What made you arrive at those numbers?
Okay, so to have fairly decent brain responses, we thought to recruit 25 to 30 children,
mm-hmm.
and of course with all the artifact rejection and all the studies, we would be lower to 23, 24, and yes. 20. The group at risk was tougher to find, so mm-hmm. that's why we have fewer numbers.
Yes.
And of course, the follow-up is not always easy. A lot of participants might just drop in there in the longitudinal design. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I noticed that you had a couple of people who were left-handed.
Yes.
In your groups, and was that a concern, or did you, do you would you normally? So I'm thinking about language lateralization in the brain being sometimes for left-handed people the other way around. Was that a concern, or did you?
No, for us we didn't.
You didn't think about it. So you didn't do any analyses of checking whether those kids were different in any way.
No, we didn't take that. No.
Okay. So, still just thinking about your design and the approach that you used. So obviously you're here in this centre of evoked responses, where a lot of your supervisory team have this long history of doing evoked responses. Did you think about doing any other kind of? I mean, we'll talk a little bit more about your stimulus design in a minute, but it was clearly set up for an evoked response kind of experiment. Did you think about studying things like event-related synchronization and desynchronization, induced changes? Was that not a consideration, or was it something you hoped to look at, or was it based on the research evidence? You know, what drove you to do this particular kind of approach based on evoked fields?
Okay.
I keep calling them ERPs, but you know, I mean evoked ERFs.
Yes. Yeah. ERFs. Yes. Okay. Yes, there were some previous studies in adults in Finnish. Of mm-hmm. course, it's not the same as children.
Yes.
They measured inflectional morphology in that mm-hmm. sense, and some measured derivational morphology. So we wanted to set a basis of the understanding of these ERFs in children. Mm-hmm. So that's why we were.
Okay. And so we might come back to the question of induced activity later on, maybe, if we've got time.
It could be, yes.
Don't worry.
For a postdoc.
Okay. Right. So I'd just like to talk through now. So you've presented all this in your presentation already, but just to get us all onto the same page, as it were, metaphorically speaking, let's think through your experimental design now. So particularly I'm thinking about your stimuli.
Okay.
Yeah. So can you just remind us so it was an auditory experiment. So what did the children hear? Describe to me what they heard.
Okay. So yes, it was an auditory experiment. Mm-hmm. So this was not for not having any effect of the ones who do not read.
Yes.
Compared to the ones who read later on or mm-hmm. on the same age.
Yeah.
So they were. We created 200 pairs of sentences. Mm-hmm. So actually they were hearing pairs of sentences in Finnish. For example, they were watching on the screen a cross, a fixation cross. Mm-hmm. Then they were hearing a subject and a verb.
Yes.
Han johtaa.
Yeah.
Which means he leads mm-hmm. in Finnish. Then they were hearing a subject and verb. And then depending on the condition, a correctly or incorrectly derived noun.
Yes.
And then they had to give a response. So we had given them small stories about, for example, a girl is having a language test in Finnish, mm-hmm. and you have to help her find the correct words.
Yes.
Or help her study which are the correct words of the Finnish language, the correct pairs of sentences.
Yes.
So he was hearing, he leads, he's a leader. And then they have to press whether it was a correct pair or not.
So they were choosing between two buttons.
Yes.
On their response device in the machine.
Yes. And then, of course, we created the correct derived words and the incorrectly derived words.
Yes. Yeah.
To have a difference.
Yes.
So the correctly derived words were just words derived mm-hmm. from the verb as normal.
Yes.
Lead, leader. The incorrectly derived words were words that had a morphophonological change in the last vowel before the suffix.
Yes.
So that was making the difference already before the suffix. For example, lead, leader.
Okay. And so the participant was listening very carefully to this and then making a button press. And how important was it then that they had this task to do? Would your studies have worked if they had... Is this the kind of linguistic process that is automatic? So if you hadn't asked them to press a button, would you have expected to see similar results? Or so what was the importance of the task as opposed to the listening?
So, yes, the results would have been the same because the button was coming a bit later after the response or the brain response was already made.
Yeah.
And then the task was to make them be more attentive.
Okay. Yes. So people would process these effects naturally, automatically?
Automatically, yes.
Anyway, or you would expect them to?
Yes, based on statistical learning and the representations that they have already created for their own language.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just... I just want to just check through my list of things that I wanted to ask. So there's a few little specifics that we might come back to when we look at the data. Okay. So I'd like to start to look at your results a little bit now. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to turn to the... Actually, before we talk about the results, there was a few things in the so your methods, the way that you write your thesis is very clear. So it was absolutely clear to me what you did. And obviously one of the great challenges of MEG work is that there are as many different ways of analysing the data as there are of doing your experiment. You know, there's umpteen different approaches that you took. And you took the approach of using some quite established software that gives you good control of your statistics and helps you test for these group differences that you wanted to do, which is the BISA software. But before you get to the point of importing your data into BISA, you use MaxFilter to process your data. And I wasn't quite sure whether you had... So MaxFilter allows you to correct for the head position of your participants, didn't it? So did you do something like that? So everybody sits in the system and their head might be... Especially with these relatively slightly smaller heads that they have at that age. Some people might be sitting like that, some people might be sitting like that. But then you're going to average data across people. Yeah. So how did you achieve that? Did you focus very carefully on making them sit in a particular position, or did you use MaxFilter to reposition their channels so that their heads were aligned? What was your approach to that?
Okay, yes. The children inside the scanner, they were sitting as as more comfortable as they could be.
Yes.
So we were not really placing them in the... We wanted their heads to be as close to the center as possible, but we were not making any more adjustments regarding this. Then, of course, to estimate the position of the head and to remove external sources of noise, we used the Max filter.
Yes.
Then in Max filter, we had to choose between two options. So one is the initial head position of the head, to use that, or the average position of the head.
Yes.
We checked with our data with both options. But when we use the average head position of the head, the differences within the participants were very big and we were getting a lot of noise.
Okay.
Because the movements were very slight, of course, they were not big ones.
There's always a little bit of movement.
But one was like this, the other was like this, and the average head position per measurement was, we checked the millimeters of change and they were quite high. So we went with the initial head position that was giving us clearer data to process next.
And is this something that you think might have been easier in EEG? Because in EEG, it depends on how you do it, but often we use the same electrode positions, don't we, on everybody? So I wonder if I sometimes wonder if that's something that's easier to, if comparing between recording sites in EEG is easier than it is in MEG, because your head can't move with respect to the position of the electrodes. I don't know.
Yeah, but then with Max filter you can fix that, so you don't really have problems later on in the analysis, and you get better data in terms of time and space. So.
Yeah, okay. No, that's fair enough. Okay, so let's have a look at your results for the first study, first of all, which is published in a very nice paper, by the way. I enjoyed reading that. We've seen your formal presentation of what the first study showed, but can you tell me in your own words what you think is the most important thing that came out of this first study?
That preschool children, both typically developing and at risk for dyslexia, were sensitive to the morphological information processing. So they have already at the preschool age, they were independently of their risk profiles, they were able to acquire the morphological information of their language and based on the representations and be able to analyze and be able to be to recognize these differences in their languages between correctly and incorrectly derived real words independently of the
And that was shown in the brain data. But in the behavioural data, you saw some differences between the groups.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's really interesting. And I'd like to look at that. I'd like us to just think about that a little bit more.
Yes.
First of all, what do you think it means if you have something where the groups differ behaviourally, but you don't see a difference between groups? I'm hesitating because I'm thinking I'm jumping ahead of myself a little bit more, but since you mentioned it, we may backtrack in a minute.
Thank you very much for the question. Yes, I understand it. So in the behavioural differences, we saw significant differences. But at the brain level, we also saw differences regarding the time points and the locations of activation. They were a bit later or earlier, but they were not significant.
No.
So in that sense, we might need more participants, or we might need the children to develop more their more automatic language skills so that they...
Yeah. So let's unpick this a little bit more. So, how would you know? So I'm asking you these questions. I don't necessarily think there's an answer that I'm not fishing for a particular answer, but I'm interested to know how you might be able to distinguish between those two options that you've given. Is there a way that you could look at the data and say, well, we would find something if we had more participants, versus we would need to look at different children? Which is it? Do you know? Or maybe you can't tell.
No, actually I cannot know, because we have to try both options and see what might give answer to that.
So I'm wondering, I guess, whether there would be a way that you could do a power calculation. So you can do these statistical power calculations, but the problem with power calculations, of course, is you have to know what sort of effect size you're expecting to get in the first place.
And in that case, we didn't know what the results to expect, because at this age group, there were no previous studies to set a basis of what we were going. There were only adult studies, but of course,
Yeah.
Children and adults have already some differences, so we cannot really rely on that.
And do you have a sense, so your youngest children were in this preschool, or just preschool age?
Kindergarten, yes.
Yeah. Now, is there anything in the literature that tells you, so it might not be studies on derivational morphology, but is there anything else that tells you about the speed at which relevant developmental changes happen before that? So, you know, for example, if you got children who are a year younger or 2 years younger, based on what you know about language and psycholinguistics, would you expect to see something different to what you found, you know, if the groups were further apart, if the groups were younger, like, is what we want to think about at this point.
The differences we can see in infants are phonetic and phonological, so the infants can discriminate the phonetic and phonological representations of their language. Then later on, from 2 to 4 years old, there is a Finnish study that studied inflectional morphology.
Okay.
So there was a task. It was like the WAG test, made from the WAG test, mm-hmm. that basically you say you have to play with the inflectional morphology, the plural forms.
Okay.
So children were already able to distinguish inflectional morphology rules by that age. So then they might move to derivational morphology during development.
Yeah, okay. So sometime between those time points, between your age group and that, you said 2 to 4. So it could be. Yeah, okay. That's interesting. Yeah. So that would be something for further study, really, to see when that kicks in. Yeah. So you might have seen... Yeah, okay. Let's not speculate. So you get these lovely time series.
Yes.
So I'm looking at this picture on page 39, but it doesn't matter specifically which one I'm looking at the moment.
Yeah.
With different changes, and it's showing that you get significant... effects for your different stimuli at particular times. And I wondered if you could... So we talked a bit earlier about the reason for using brain data is to unpick mechanisms. Yeah, and we agreed that's what the brain data gives us, that behavioural data doesn't. So behavioural data tells you whether somebody can do something. Yeah. And if you're really clever, you can get at mechanisms through behavioural data as well. But the brain data is telling us, particularly with MEG, about the time course of events in the brain. So when you look at these time... So you have these time courses where you see... you see differences... in the responses for the correct and incorrect stimuli. First, just looking at in the typically developing group, for example, at the moment, you see differences across timescales from very, very early, so really soon after... We have to remember to add a bit of time to these times, don't we? So in your stimuli, when it says 25 milliseconds, that's...
That's a time range, and the 25 milliseconds is the maximum point of activation.
It's the maximum point.
Yes.
And the time that they will have first been able to hear the difference is actually just is before zero, isn't it? It's about minus 100,
yes.
Is that right?
Minus 100.
So when it says... So I'm trying to get at... When it says 25... I'm trying to think... I'll start again... I'm trying to think, in terms of the auditory system, when does this chain, this difference that they are listening for, hit the auditory system? When you've marked 25 milliseconds, that sound, that auditory difference, has gone in the ear 125 milliseconds before that point on your graph. Is that correct? Have I understood that? Right. Okay, yeah. So, tell me, what do you know about typical auditory evoked responses? So if we were just looking at the auditory response to a tone pip or something like that, about when would you see, what are the waves that you would see typically? Do you know?
Okay. So in our analysis first, we had 3-time windows of analysis,
mm-hmm.
from 0 to 300.
Yes.
So we take the early phonological representations. That we could have. Then we had from 300 to 700, where we checked for possible N400 responses because of the incongruent endings of the incorrectly derived nouns. And then we checked for the later responses, a possible P600 response, the early and the late P600 responses.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to come back to that a little bit.
Okay.
So what I was thinking about, see, this is your background is in, well, now you're an MEG expert and an expert in all of this, and you can come at it from a psycholinguistics perspective originally before you was, and I'm afraid I'm an inveterate neurophysiologist. So I like to think about what if you reduce this to the simplest auditory stimulus that you can think of, so that would be a click or a tone pip or something like that. So I'm imagining that so you don't see the typical auditory response here because you have a sentence coming before this change, you have other parts of the stimulus coming before this change. So you're not going to see the response that I'm talking about now. But if you imagine that it was there, you would see a response from about 50 to 100 in the MEG signal, from about 50 to 150 milliseconds, I guess, which would be the earliest response arriving. So not the earliest, but the bulk of the response arriving at the auditory system, and the auditory system is doing, we're seeing the electrophysiological signal of the auditory system doing stuff with that sound, processing it, processing the information in it, which if it's a click or a tone pip is not as much information. So your response at 125 milliseconds is showing that these children are responding really quickly to the information that's present in your stimulus, isn't it? So that's a really rapid, actually quite a rapid.
That is true, but I also have to mention that before that signal corresponds to the second pairs of sentences and the last word, the yotaya.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're
so
not.
So there is already prediction when a verb and,
right.
and
yeah.
the.
Okay.
When the subject and the verb is coming, then they predict what might come first. And of course, there is a bit automatization and a repetitive mode in the task, so they already predict very early what might come.
Yes.
And this prediction might be correct or not.
Yes.
Based on the stimuli. If it's incorrectly, then the predictions were not.
Absolutely. So that's what I was getting at. So there's presumably some sort of top-down
processes for phonological and phonetic and phonological representations that they are already stored in the brain or in the mental lexicon.
Right. So the way I wanted to work, so you've kind of addressed some of what I wanted to ask you, but we'll go through this anyway. So I want to get a feel for is in terms of mechanisms, what's happening? So you've got these time points from 25 or 125 milliseconds all the way through to a second, so you're seeing differences at 1,000 milliseconds plus. So just take me through then, in the detail that you've just given me, which was excellent, about what's happening at this very early 25 millisecond point. So this is phonological information, or phonetic phonological information, that is associated not only with the signal itself, but with the expectations of what the stimulus is going to contain. So what happens? So then at 300 and 480, you've mentioned briefly what's happening, but can you give me a really detailed story of what the brain is doing at these different time points? So you said, the N400 comes next. So what does that mean? Tell me what that means in terms of mechanisms.
Yes, we can talk about the typically developing group. So this early 25 milliseconds, but it's not really 25, it's a time range.
Yes.
It's the early phonetic phonological responses in the upcoming stimuli when you recognize native phonetic contrasts of your language. Then the 300 and 480 milliseconds could represent the N400 responses when the brain detects the semantic violation in the case of the incorrectly derived words or the non.
Yes.
The semantic violation. And then the later ones can be the 520, 22 milliseconds, well, in that time range, mm-hmm. it can represent the P600 responses when there is a violation in the whole context of a sentence.
Okay.
And then they try, because in the first grade children, we see two P600 processing stages. The one is getting the syntactic integration, and the other is doing reconstruction processes and repair. So you get the wrong, let's say, context of a sentence, and then you try to fix it.
So we could think of it in terms of a hierarchy of just the basic, the sort of not very far from acoustic, the phonetic and phonological information, and then the semantic, and then the. So it's kind of a hierarchy.
Exactly, it's a continuum, and yes, it's very nice to see it here that we start from phonology, morphophonology, and then syntactic and semantic.
So it's a hierarchy in terms of information. Would you expect to see? So we appreciate that you haven't got source modelling here, so you're not able to from your data to speak directly to which brain areas are doing this. But if you could speculate on the brain areas involved, is it all coming from the same? Well, so I know you do have some spatial information. It's wrong to say that you don't. You do have spatial information, but can you be any more specific about whether there is a network or a pathway of brain areas that are involved in these different phases? Because it's not all coming from the same place, is it?
Yes. No. They are not coming from the same places. And usually it's from the temporal region that is activated. And then in children at risk for dyslexia, we sometimes see bilateral activations. And here we spot the differences, which are not significant, but...
Interesting. So just deviating into the bilateral thing, is there any other evidence to suggest that that might be important? I mean, from what you know about dyslexia, so you mentioned it, the bilateral. Did you mention it because you think it's important?
Yes, because I think that they might need to use more mechanisms, more brain mechanisms, to process the upcoming stimuli, or they have already set up different brain mechanisms for specific language-related processes.
So let's look at, so in your at-risk group then, as you say, there isn't a significant overall group difference, but you make the point in your thesis about how they seem to be either sort of slower or slightly later, as well as being more bilateral. So what does that mean? Can you give me any interpretation of what that means? You know, so what does it mean to be slower? I mean, does it, what's happening differently in those brains?
Well, this would be very good studied by a connectivity analysis to see which brain areas are connected.
Yes.
But we don't have it here. They perceive they process the information slower. So mm-hmm. in that sense, they might be slower readers or slower learners. And they don't reach the automatization of a language that quickly as the typically developing group, probably.
And in terms of the signal, this is me being an inveterate neurophysiologist again now, but in terms of the signal, so when we see a signal that's later, I guess, or smaller, well, actually, in fact, your at-risk group showed larger responses, didn't they? Yeah. So later but larger. And what do we think that might mean in terms of what's happening at the neural level? Can you speculate on that at all? Or do you not think about, do you prefer not to? So with the EEG signal, what are we measuring? Not EEG, MEG, sorry.
Okay.
With the MEG signal, what are we measuring? What do you need to happen in the brain for an MEG signal to be recorded?
To fire the magnetic field in the brain that is fired
to get
by
something
the electric
that's
current
measurable.
Of the brain.
Yeah. Yes. So what we need is synchrony, I guess. So if there's only synapses in a few, events at synapses in a few neurons, or if it happens in loads of them but not all at the same time, then we don't get a measurable signal because we need we need an area of a few millimetres of cortex to all be doing the same thing at the same time for us to pick it up with the MEG signal. So I guess that perhaps if... if we think about neurons generally aren't doing nothing. They're generally doing something, but they might change their firing pattern in response to a stimulus. So I was just wondering if you it doesn't matter if you haven't thought about this particularly, but but one could think about, you know, if somebody's response is later but larger, perhaps that tells us something about information processing. You know, can we interpret that in terms of meaning that their neural responses are slower to synchronize, or I don't know. I guess it's your data. It's just a thought, really.
Yes,
I don't want to.
That's a quite interesting question. Yes, or they need more resources to process an upcoming stimuli or linguistic process, and they need to fire more places in the brain in order to do that, because.
And I guess if the response is bigger, maybe that means they're recruiting a larger area of cortex.
Yes.
So it's possible to think. I mean, this is, I think with brain data, this is one of the things, is it's possible to think. You can't always answer these questions.
No.
But you could generate hypotheses about how neural responses may differ. And of course, there may be different explanations. You know, so it could be that the synchrony is less. For a larger response, it could be that there's greater synchrony in a given population, or it could be that the population has got a little bit bigger, and we don't know the difference, but it's interesting to think about that. Okay, let me just check. Tell me a little bit more about your non-word stimuli and what you hope to get from those.
Okay. So in the paradigm, we had the real words and the non-words. Okay. With the real words, we take the statistical learning and the morphophonological representations that they are already established in the brain. With the pseudo words, we check if these morphological rules, let's say, are established in the brain, and if they can form these rules in words that they don't have any meaning. So we have in the pseudo words, we have the correctly derived and the incorrectly derived.
Mm-hmm.
And the incorrectly derived pseudo words, of course, they have no meaning. The correctly derived pseudo words, again, they have no meaning, but they have, they could be possible finished words, are not.
Yes.
So they might be processed in a different way.
Yeah. And did you find that in terms of your results, were your findings for the non-words as you expected, or did you expect to find anything different?
Okay, actually we had a very interesting finding in the first grade children, where the typically developing group didn't show any differences between the correctly and incorrectly derived pseudo words.
Yes.
And that was quite surprising, because the group at risk showed these differences for the same stimuli. And then I searched a bit in the literature, and there were previous studies that they have already found the same results. And they interpret it as when you get a pseudo word with a real suffix at the end, then it's you get it as a possible word. So it's more complicated it's more difficult to process it. So maybe the at-risk children, they don't have already the representations in the brain, the morphophonological ones, so they can process it, let's say, easier, because they process it as a word, because they don't have this representation. But the typically developing, knowing that it is not, then they cannot process it and find the difference between that.
Yeah.
Because they get stuck, not stuck, but yes, to the real suffix at the end.
Yes.
And they are driven. Their responses are driven from that.
was quite interesting. So we've kind of skipped forward to study two, haven't we? But that's okay. Would you like to just give a summary of the rest, just so that we all know where we're up to, and for the benefit of anybody who hasn't read your thesis, just remind us what you think is the most important findings from study two. Although it may be that you've just described that, but what else did we learn from study two when you were looking at the older children?
Yes, from study two we can also learn that the children already having at preschool the knowledge about morphology, they use it also at first grade.
Yes.
And they use a similar pattern, probably until adulthood.
Yeah.
Then the interesting result was that of the at-risk children, that they were able to process the pseudo words, but not the group,
yes,
the typically developing group. And then we had no non-significant differences between the group, the typically developing, and the group at risk for dyslexia. Again, they had, in some cases, different topographies or similar topographies, but
yes,
the differences were not significant between them.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. And do you think, so there's a, we talk a lot about heterogeneity in,
yes,
neurodevelopmental disorders, don't we, and how, so this is kind of, this is almost jumping back to what we should have talked about at the beginning, but this, it's kind of coming back to this idea of why didn't, so even though you see differences, they don't necessarily turn out to be significant, and this
no.
could be due to statistical power, or it could be for other reasons. But heterogeneity is a big question, isn't it? And perhaps with an at-risk sample, so you don't know yet. Somebody may one day know how many of these children turn out to have dyslexia. Do you have a sense of how heterogeneous they are, in particular, I guess that in the Finnish language as well, the statistics of what risk means, family risk, for, it might be different to what I'm used to in dyslexia in England. You know, how much is the at-risk, the approach of looking at risk children, a potential confound in terms of heterogeneity of the sample? You know, could.
Yeah. That's true that we used groups that they were at risk for dyslexia and they were not diagnosed as dyslexics. So that means that in the future, only approximately 30% of them will develop dyslexia and or
yes.
reading difficulties, and the others will just develop as typical readers.
Yes.
They will develop normally. So this is also a factor that might be responsible for not finding the group differences between them.
And to what extent do you think that the any effects that you see are associated with, so even though they might not all turn out to be dyslexic, they still have the risk of dyslexia, and do you think there are any brain differences that might be just associated with risk? So maybe some people have, so maybe a subset of the children have the same risk of dyslexia. Mm. Some of them will become dyslexic and some of them won't, but that might be not because their risk is different. It might be because there are other protective factors, such as the home environment or other, you know, cognitive skills, for example, that help to protect against dyslexia. Does that question make sense?
Yes, it makes
so
sense.
So is it, I suppose what I'm asking is it interesting to, is it particular, is risk itself interesting to look at as opposed to just a confound?
Yes, it's very interesting because there is a lot of individual variability between an at-risk group, as you said, the parents' background, education, it could affect the home literacy, the language.
Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
And other, the behavioural assessments and cognitive tests.
Okay. Right, just let me check where we're up to here. Are you okay? So, can we this is a detail now, but I remember when I read your thesis the first time, there's a question, isn't there, about whether the push button, the response that you're getting people to do, is showing up in your data. Do you think any of the later portions of the effects that you see in the time series are connected to task-related conditions, task-related factors? So motor preparation responses and things like that. What do you think the influence of things like that might be in your data? So this is leading to a question that is, so first of all about motor things, but also if you were going to redesign your brain recordings, is there anything you'd do differently?
Actually, in that late motor responses, we got them in all of the groups in the third time window, and we thought that it was a preparation for the button press.
Yes.
Like the thought of whether it's which button press to choose. I don't think I would have done anything differently for now, because it gives us a very nice understanding of what is happening and how they are sensitive into derivational morphology. And then the populations are very interesting to study. So it's a very good basis for future studies that they can be more specific, like source localization or connectivity, and then we can pick from these studies and do further stuff.
Yeah, okay, that's good. And of course, your experimental design was strongly founded in the literature. So you knew what you were doing when you set out to do that. So let's say then, imagine that you have MRIs on all these children, and imagine that you have all the time and resources and computing power that you could need. What other analyses would you wish to do of the data? You know, is there anything particular that you would wish to do?
That's very interesting, because it's not a supposing question. We have MRIs of the children.
Oh, okay.
So, yes, it's my next step for the postdoc, because a PhD takes a lot of time to do source localization. I would be very interested into that. And we actually checked the source localization in 5 participants already by importing their MRIs. It was a bit tough at first to draw conclusions, but I think I need more expertise and time to focus on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And with source localization, what is it particularly that you want to get out of it? So it's always interesting to know where things come from, but is there anything particular so what might you clarify about the findings? Is there anything particular that you'd hope to quantify or test with the source localization data?
Yes, probably check the reading-related areas, temporal areas, the visual.
So which brain areas do you think?
The temporal areas, occipital areas I would like, and probably create areas of interest and check what they could, activate this.
And what would, so if we think about that network in the left, that's typically in the left hemisphere, sort of from going from the temporal lobe around the temporoparietal junction areas there, and then frontal areas. How might you, would you predict, so thinking about your graphs which have these things happening in particular time points, would you make any predictions about which part, and also thinking about what we've said about the links between phonology and morphology, within that network, do you have any predictions about what might be the really interesting thing, where might you expect to see the really stimulus-specific effects, and where might you expect to see any group differences?
I would guess in the left frontotemporal areas.
Okay.
And probably in the at-risk group in the right frontotemporal areas as well.
Okay, so that's really interesting. You'd expect to see this hemispheric.
I think it could
effect.
Be.
Effect.
The case. Of course, from this one, we cannot really talk about source localization.
No, of course. No, it's purely speculation.
But it's just ideas.
But given that you're doing it, obviously it's also not in your thesis, so I can't really give you a hard time about it. But I'm just interested to know Because it speaks really to your interpretation of what's happening at these different time points.
And also probably from the parietal areas, I could say.
Yeah, okay. So actually you're saying really the whole of the, you would expect to see differences at different time points right through the whole of that left hemisphere network, but possibly some lateralization. Yeah.
Yes.
Differences in lateral. So do you think that the main difference between the at-risk group and the typically developing group would be in hemispheric lateralization? Is that your feeling? Or
I don't have a sense on that, it could be. It's an option. And now without taking data, I cannot know.
No, we shouldn't drill too much into things that you haven't measured, have we? But it's interesting.
It's
interesting.
Very interesting, yeah. Yes.
Okay. Oh, so I haven't asked you to summarise chapter 3 yet, have I? What is the most important? So rather than going over all the details, because we've already seen the details of study 3, so study 3 that is, what do you think is the most important thing that you learned from that? What did it tell you that we didn't know before?
So in study 3 we measured behavioral and brain measures of morphological processing.
Mm-hmm.
So we correlated behavioral tasks between preschool age and first grade age. So in that we gave more importance in the age factor, so to compare both time points of the longitudinal sample. A big result is that the preschool children's cognitive skills were strongly correlated with the first grade cognitive skills, and that's a replication in the literature.
Yes.
So across languages, they have found that a lot of behavioral tasks at preschool age, they correlate with first grade or other grades. So it was quite interesting to see that this happens as well in these children. And then the other very interesting result, because we examined the associations between morphological processing skills during the MEG and the first grade reading and behavioral tasks, and we found out that the preschool behavior, preschool morphological processing was correlated with the first grade run of letters.
Yeah, okay. So, and can you tell me a little bit more about what that means then? So RAN is a measure of
RAN is a measure of fluency, of speed, of naming speed.
Yeah.
It could be letters, objects, or colors.
So, So what does that associate? Does that association, so it's an important association. Tell me a bit more about what it means. Why is it important?
So it was an interesting association that we found. In the RAN task is a measure of reading speed, and in this it was quite automatic. It's quite automatic,
mm-hmm.
And this morphological processing task, the reaction time through the repetition of the stimuli. It became quite automatic based on the representations and the expectations.
Yes.
So we might share automaticity of the responses, and they might be that when you perceive the letters, then you have also morphological skills
So
IQ reaction times into that.
So it's something to do with the automation. That is the common factor.
I could interpret it like this.
Yeah,
yes.
That's interesting. Because there was a theory. There was a theory about dyslexia that was to do with automatization. Though I always think that's the wrong automation. It was called automatization, but automation that was to do with that was connected to the motor theories of dyslexia as well. So that's interesting. So. Okay, but I wanted to just let me gather my thoughts, because I wanted to ask you something else. Right, so if this is a very broad question, but if skills in preschool predict skills in first grade quite strongly and across the board, what can a teacher do to help children who are struggling? Because it suggests, one interpretation of that is that whatever you're like in preschool is basically going to predict how you are a year later and maybe a year after that. How, you know, is school not having, does that imply that teaching, the reading instruction, is not having any differential effect, you know, so that children that are struggling, that are in preschool and may have particular weaknesses are not being helped by the current way that they're being instructed to read, or can we not interpret it that way? Because you might think that if school is successful, then there'd be no relationship between how they come in and how they are a year later.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question that I hadn't thought before, but yeah. Well, I think that the school gives you the opportunity to create and advance the already established mechanisms that you have and teaching strategies. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't teach you, but it gives you the strategies of how to perform better, at least in typically developing children.
Yes.
The children at risk, or the dyslexic ones, they are not usually diagnosed on the first grade, so they might be slow readers.
Yes.
At least in Finnish. So the special education teachers might use these tasks or this to help them later on.
Okay, right. Yes. Yeah, so that catching up would come at a later stage, possibly.
Yes, around third grade, when they are officially diagnosed as dyslexic or with reading difficulties.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Right. So, do you think, so this is a provocative question. Okay. Do you think that there would be, so you see some behavioural differences that are not reflected statistically at the group level in the brain responses? Okay, and that's kind of a feature throughout your thesis, isn't it? And probably it reflects this heterogeneity, it reflects the fact that it's also quite difficult to tap. Sometimes it's quite difficult to design the most sensitive brain experiments that are suitable for everybody in your group. But if you were going to, and we already touched on, would you do your experiment differently? And the answer is no. But if you wanted to get at some of these effects that you, let's say you wanted to design not a scientific study to understand what's happening with derivational morphology. But let's say you wanted to design an MEG experiment to test and to pick out people who are weaker, at children who are at a certain age weaker at doing tasks of derivational morphology. How would you do that? Is there, what aspects of the tasks that you've got would you focus in on to try and get that statistical difference? Because if something's different at the statistically different at the behavioural level, surely there's a way of measuring that at the brain level. Yeah. What is it? What aspect of it that would you change about how you're measuring data? Does that make sense?
It makes sense. Yes. So one thing that I could try in the future is, instead of using sentences that they are more difficult to process and longer to process, so you might smoothen the responses, to use words.
Okay.
Only.
Yeah.
Monomorphemic.
And why would that?
And polymorphemic words.
Okay. Right.
And see the differences into that.
Right.
Again, they could be correctly derived or incorrectly derived, or depends on which morphological aspect you test. If it's plural number for inflectional morphology, or if it's past tense, or.
Yeah.
Yeah. It really depends on the language. That
absolutely. And what about the age of the children? Would you choose a group, if you could have that part again, would you choose to include, and so admittedly, within the context of a PhD, it's already remarkable to have any longitudinal component at all. But imagine you had loads of time. Would you choose another age group? Would you incorporate a younger age group or an older age group, for example? What would your...
So I measured the pre-literate. So now I would like at risk for dyslexia. So now I would like to measure the dyslexic participant.
Ah, okay,
so
right.
From third grade to 12th,
yeah,
probably.
Yeah.
And adolescents would be also interested, but then adults as well.
Okay. So why adolescents? Tell me more about adolescents. Why would that be interesting?
Because the adolescents are a step between children and adults, so there are a lot of studies that they see differences in adolescents for them.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So I'm going to ask you just a few quite broad questions now about the overall interpretation. So I'm going to move away from thinking about the details of your studies. But so I want to start with this, which is so we're thinking really about the implications and the impact of your research now. So looking at all the results that you found and these differences at the brain level and behaviourally, and taking into account the fact that the results aren't as clear, they're probably not as clear cut as they could have been. Because it's complicated, and you've revealed that there's a really complicated pattern of things going on here, but with some clear trajectories in those timelines and in those cortical distributions. Does all this work, when you look at it together, does it tell us anything new about reading disability or about dyslexia? What do we know about those at-risk children that we didn't know before? Just taking a step back from it.
Okay, we know that their brain responses, they are not significant differently, but they deviate from the at-risk group, and they probably, since very young age, they develop different mechanisms, different neural mechanisms regarding derivational morphology. Then I would also like to add some inflectional morphology studies and compare the two processes.
Okay.
I would really like to do that and see who develops first, or this might be a very interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as I said before, to take other ages of children, like older ones.
Yeah. So you think that so certainly you're content that the work that you've done has added something, and it's obviously leading to suggestions of other avenues that you can pursue. If you had to give a talk now to somebody, to let's say that this room was full of special education teachers, and you had been asked to tell them, you know, what from your work, what you could tell them about the children that they work with, you know, in terms of applications, does your work give any clues that or any strong sort of indicators of how teachers might intervene with those children, for example, or where they should be looking, how they should be supporting children? Does that
they should see dyslexia as a comorbid deficit that has a lot of reading and learning difficulties, and not only focus on the phonological aspect of the problems.
Yeah.
There are also visual ones. There might be morphological ones there, or other kinds of. So they should have specific language-specific mechanisms to teach the children with dyslexia, and also that each children is a different world.
Yes.
So they could adjust the needs of the kid into that, and they shouldn't not treat, but teach all of them in the same way, because there might be differences within them and within its class.
Okay, so that heterogeneity is really important. Okay, so is there anything else about your thesis that you think that we haven't covered that you would like to raise?
One minor thing is that the stimuli that we used, they were naturally produced,
okay.
So they are environmentally friendly,
mm-hmm.
and they represent the normal speech.
Yes.
Instead, and that probably gave us more complications into the analysis.
Okay.
So they might make the responses more smoother instead mm-hmm. of having, because its stimuli was a bit different in milliseconds compared to the other ones, so averaging them, there might be smooth differences. The responses might be smoother. But if we were using technical or very morpheme stim or smaller ones, it might be easier to find the peak and the differences between the two groups.
With synthetic stimuli.
With synthetic
stimuli. Absolutely. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, so I think that what's clear is that you've taken a very difficult and complicated set of experiments and made a lot of sense out of the results. So I don't have any more questions, but I would I should make a final statement. So thank you, Natalia, for a very interesting discussion about your thesis.
Thank you very much for all your constructive comments on my thesis.
You're most welcome. And again, having talked about it, I am still struck by the volume of work that you have conducted, by your extreme attention to detail, and the very clear way in which you have described your findings, and the expertise that you bring to the table in terms of interpretation and in being able to explain the implications and the impact of your work, which is absolutely exemplary. I also think that this your thesis is a very good representation of the scientific journey that you have been on, in your journey from being a psycholinguistic to a neuroscientist and an expert on MEG, which is really important, and also the contribution that you have made, that your research has made, because you've produced something that is new, that has not been done before, and you have added new knowledge to our understanding of this particular important aspect of linguistic function and how it relates to these really important times in a child's life where they make this transition from not being at school to being literate and able to function to the best of their ability in society. So you should be very proud of this contribution that you have made. And I see it really as the starting point of a scientific journey for that topic area, where, as you say, there's lots more to do, but you have made those first steps. So many congratulations on that. And I'm very happy to say that I recommend that the Faculty of Education and Psychology do accept this dissertation for the degree of Doctor of Philosophy, without reservation.
So, if anyone here has any critical comments to make on my dissertation, please ask the custos for the floor. Okay, there is coffee and cake outside, so please join us.